You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today we are talking about the story of Veramed, love and statistics, and there's lots you can learn from it. Matt and Emma have built an awesome company. And being a couple, of course, that has a very, very interesting spin to it. And in this episode, you'll learn a lot about how they made that happen, what a kind of company culture they have created, and how they drive a CRO business that is growing really, really fast while still having a family life and getting kids. And it's a really, really interesting episode because we can take so much away from it in terms of how we should conduct business, what are the priorities, and where to focus on to be successful. If you haven't done that yet, join the LinkedIn group, The Effective Statistician, and follow me on LinkedIn, where I give you a lot of additional content, a lot of things to think about, a lot of things to act upon, to help boost your career as a statistician. This podcast is produced in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rate is just £20 for non-high-income countries and £95 for high-income countries. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to an episode of the Effective Statistician Podcast. And this time I'm not alone. I'm here with Matt and Emma from Veramed. And it's quite unusual situation for me because usually I'm sitting at home and just in front of my microphone. This time I'm actually here at your office. So welcome, Matt and Emma here.
Thank you for coming.
Okay, so let's dive directly into the content. So Matt, you founded Veramed. What's the founding story of Veramed, and why did you actually start your own business?
Sure. Well, I've been a programmer for a number of years. I joined the industry in about 99. And I've been learning new things, working for various different companies as a freelancer and as a permanent employee as well. And I wasn't one of those people who had always known what they wanted to do when they grew up. I wasn't sure. I kind of fell into this industry, but found myself as a programmer and found that I could do it, and I was quite good at it. But I kind of got to the point where I'd stopped learning, and I wasn't really learning new things, and realized that was quite important to me. In about, 2006, something like that, I went and did an MBA. So I thought, I'm quite interested in business. I was quite inspired growing up by people who ran their own businesses. My dad had his own business, and my uncle had his own business. My cousins kind of ran some of my uncle's businesses and stuff like that. So I thought, one day I might like to do that. So I went and did this MBA and, got a good solid kind of grounding in business and business related stuff, finance.
You did that while you were still programming?
Yeah, I did it part time. Okay. So I did what's called an executive MBA. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of Friday and Saturday every other week. I was going to study, and then I would take the Friday off in between and do some extra study. So it's quite intensive over 2 years. I did that thinking it would kind of give me all the answers, and I'd come out thinking, great, I know exactly what I want to do. I went back to programming straight away. So, okay, I was freelancing some more. And then, I met Emma and we were together, and, we were talking about my career and what I should do. And she said, well, why don't you kind of give it a go and set up your own business? And we've been talking about doing it together, but just thought, maybe that's the right time. And Emma kind of gave me a bit of a push that I needed, and just went for it. I think at the same time, I was working on the pharma side as well. And I could see that some CROs in the marketplace were not doing an especially good job. The studies that I was overseeing were coming in, and they were relatively, poor quality, or they were late, or the service was bad. And I just thought, you know, maybe we could make a go of this and do it a little bit better. So started Veramed.
So your goal for Veramed was more quality?
Yes. Yeah. So it was, well, it was kind of three things really. One was quality. So I'm always passionate about doing a really good job. I'm quite a conscientious person and, you know, that's important to me. It kind of makes me tick. So it was the quality angle, but also the service angle as well. You know, I worked when I was younger in restaurants and on a holiday park and things like that. And you get used to the kind of service element. And what I'd seen in pharma was that, you know, communication was sometimes not great from providers, and sometimes things were late and you wouldn't even know that they were going to be late. You were expecting, you know, a set of deliverables to turn up and they just wouldn't turn up. And I just thought, actually, we can have a go at having a kind of high quality company, a high service company, but also being a good place to work as well.
Okay. So good place to work, high quality and good service. So what does service beyond communication mean to you, Matt?
Well, it's the whole thing, really. So I think service you can boil down to, you know, good communication and being attentive, responsive to emails. But it's not just that. I think for us, service is kind of two things. It's understanding what the client's problems are, perhaps kind of making those problems your own, or mm-hmm. treating them as your own problems, so that, you know, you kind of go the extra mile to help address your client's needs. But it's not just that. I think it's also about taking care as well. So one of the things that we do a lot of project management work behind the scenes that nobody really sees. It's something that we've built, I suppose, part of our IP. But what we use that for is to, as accurately as possible, forecast all of the work that we're going to need to do on all of the projects across the entire business. So we've got a very clear picture month on month of exactly what resource we're going to need or not need, or what capacity we've got or not got. And what that allows us to do is to communicate with our customers. Firstly, to say when they've got a new project, not just yes, it's yes, but we can do it, not do it, you know, this month, we could do it next month, or actually no, I'm really sorry, but we can't take this project on because it would exceed our capacity and we won't be able to deliver it to the levels of quality or timelines that you actually want. And, you know, clients are responding really well to that because they know that if they give us a project, then it's in safe hands and it's going to get delivered. And that's something that we've seen elsewhere within the industry, where there's a bit of a disconnect, if you like, between the, I suppose, the sales function and the operation function within.
So the sales function can always, oh, of course we can do that, and to any timelines that you propose.
Well, I have to say, we have just hired a salesperson. It might all change.
Yeah, but I think that's a really, really good point, because I also rather want to work with a CRO that tells me there's a problem, or there's, you know, we can't deliver on that because we wouldn't have, never could recruit good people in that amount of time to deliver on these kind of things, because then I can manage for myself kind of, and potentially, you know, find a different solution. I can internally say, oh, we need to modify things because we cannot get to that timeline. But if I learn about things kind of too late, then I have no room to maneuver anymore, and I rather have someone that tells me, okay, there's a problem. Also, when you, through the process, something comes up and says something went south for whatever reason, and, you know, we have complex projects, so there's always something that doesn't plan out how it should be or how we thought it would be. And having then this openness to discuss that and bring it up, I think is really, really important.
I think it has to be a two-way relationship. I think you're right. It's like any relationship in life. But, you know, it's the fact that there are always going to be challenges. There's going to be a lot of successes as well, but there's always going to be challenges, and it's working together to figure out how you work your way through those. If you can establish that level of honesty and openness and communication, you know, within a personal relationship or within a professional relationship, it's going to be more successful. It's just, you know, inevitable.
Speaking about relationship, Emma, you joined Matt a couple of months after he started this business. And Matt mentioned you kind of pushed him a little bit or decreased the hurdles for him to be able to jump into it. What did you do to kind of make him feel comfortable to move into that area?
Well, I guess I could see he wasn't so happy just continuing contracting. He'd become quite bored with the work, and he, as he said himself, he wasn't learning new things. And so we talked about it a lot, and I guess I encouraged him to say, you know, what's the worst that could happen? The business didn't become successful. You could carry on doing the job that you have as a contract programmer. So that's, I suppose, the encouragement I gave him. And even I think they pointed to someone else that we knew that he'd recently started a business and said, look, you know, if they can do it, you can do it. So I think that was part of the motivation.
Okay. And you were working at Lilly at the time.
Yeah.
And so you always had a kind of second income.
Mm-hmm.
You still had no kids at that time.
No.
So it was kind of more a less risk-averse setting,
yeah.
So to say.
So I had never really ever thought about running a business. It wasn't something I had ever crossed my radar as something that I would want to do. I did my master's in statistics. I then did a PhD. And then I was working at Lilly as a project statistician. And after about 6 months with Matt working and starting Verimed, there was Matt plus a few programmers delivering one project that was predominantly programming. And in order to continue on that project, they needed a statistician. And Matt was obviously married to a statistician.
It was all part of the game plan.
And the gentle persuasion and encouragement came from Matt to leave my role at Lilly and to join him and join forces and see if we could continue to grow Verimed together. So, yeah, so in the September of 2012, I left Lilly and then joined Verimed full time. I had zero business experience. I'd not done an MBA. I'd never line managed anybody. What could go wrong?
So how did that feel, actually, kind of leaving your secure job at Lilly? Well, it was at least secure at the time.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the point. In that particular time, there were many pharma companies that were making staff redundant. GSK had gone through a similar phase, other companies. And I just thought, well, actually, there are a lot of people contracting, so if the business doesn't work out, I felt confident that I could find another role, if not back with Lilly, with somewhere else. So we just thought, let's see what happens and let's take the risk and go for it. But as you said, at that time, I didn't have children. It didn't feel too big a risk. It felt exciting, I guess, to see what else I could be doing outside of a statistical role.
So if you speak about this outside of statistical role, what were the kind of first challenges that you took on other than, you know, doing stats work?
Yeah. So when you start a business, you wear many, many, many different hats.
Every hat.
The hats were shared between myself and Matt. So I guess my role initially, I tried to be about 4 days a week project work to pay the bills. And then one day I was doing anything from recruitment through marketing, through writing policies for our new business, and anything, emptying the bins, anything that needed to be done. I was trying to do that in my one day a week.
So 4 days working in the company, one day working on
the business.
Pretty much, yeah.
So some pretty long days, lots of evenings, and I think that's what you have to do at the beginning.
Yeah,
in any new business.
5 days, it was probably more than 5 days, wasn't it?
I'd say so. A lot of evenings, a lot of weekends, but that's...
I think that's it. You know, when you start a business, you have to be willing to put in the work. I was chatting to another business owner actually just before starting Verimed, and he said to me, you know, if you do it, you have to be willing to put the hours in. You have to like work. You have to be willing to work, because, you know, over the years we have put in you know, lots and lots of additional time, evenings, weekends, you know, routinely, because you want the business to be a success.
How does the business model for Verimet look like, and how has it evolved over time? Because I think you can't kind of run your business and think, well, in 8 years or 9 years we'll be there, and in 5 years we'll mm-hmm. be there, and in 3 years we'll be there. You probably had a very, very different evolution of your business. So how did that look like?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when we started, we didn't start with a big investment. We didn't necessarily start with, you know, a big new idea. That's how some companies are started. So our strategy was really quite an evolutionary one. We started off being all things to all people. As Emma said, any work is good work. we kind of realized over the years that, you know, we do have certain things that we do really, really well. And we kind of focus the business towards those. So in terms of our business model, I'd say now we're predominantly a functional service provider, typically working with two large pharmaceutical companies.
What does it mean, functional service provider?
It's outsourcing. So it's outsourcing from pharmaceutical companies to a CRO. Functional sourcing provider means different things to different people mm-hmm. in the marketplace. In terms of the type of work that we do, one of the FSPs, the big FSPs that we work with, is project-based outsourcing. So this is where a pharmaceutical company wants to outsource. They're making a commitment to a relationship with a vendor, essentially us. And within that, there will be lots of projects. And on that relationship, we're doing lots of project-based work. So where we're quoting for, you know, fixed price pieces of work and delivering those, you know, over, you know, whether it's 3 months, 6 months, 6 years. And, you know, that's quite successful. Another example of a functional service provider relationship is where you supply resource being people's time. So typically on a time and materials basis, that would be, what's the best way to describe it, Emma? Kind of adding to or being an extension of a kind of customer's teams.
So basically it takes the burden off the pharma organization or the biotech to kind of hire these people. They just go to you and then, you know, say
that's right.
So all the programmer statisticians work within the sponsors' processes, mm-hmm. systems, right. and everything. So it's just kind of, you know.
And different to a typical agency model, we, right from the very start, would have a lot more emphasis on us interviewing anyone that would be joining us and anyone that we would be putting forward to work with a client. So, A, we wanted to really understand what kind of person the client was looking for. Mm. Do they want someone that's very able to interact with and have a strong personality to interact with other study team members? Or they want someone that's very, very technical for a certain aspect? Or both?
Everybody is looking for, you know, the person that can do everything, isn't it?
But then, we do get requests for unicorns sometimes.
But then when we're interviewing people is really understanding their strengths and what kind of role that individual is looking for, because not everyone wants to do the same thing. Yeah. Some people do have a more technical urge that they want to be doing and learning very, very technical things. Other people want to be focusing more on the project aspect of a stats role. So there are various different roles. And what we've realized over the years is actually how we can best match the person to the role that we have, to the projects that we have. And that's something that we're quite passionate about. Yeah. So that it leads to people being happy in what they do. They want to continue in what they're doing. The client then is happy because they've got a team that are engaged and motivated. So what we've seen over the years is quite a high staff retention rate, because we feel that we're really proactive in hiring the right people for the right roles.
When you talked about these three different points at the beginning, kind of service and quality and then a good place to work for, I think if you create the third one, you get the service and the quality kind of automatically.
They're both self-fulfilling, actually. Both kind of sides, the service and the quality and the place to work. So I think what we've observed is that if you're a company that delivers on its promises and you deliver work to a high quality, you know, we're proud of it as business owners, but the people working on those projects, our teams, you know, they're exceptionally proud of it as well. You know, we routinely get positive feedback from our customers about, you know, for a job well done. And that makes people feel happy and recognise and acknowledge for what they're providing. And so, you know, that kind of fulfills things that way. But also, you know, if you were to go into the office at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening, it's a ghost town. So maintaining the good work-life balance and, as Emma kind of touched on, having training and development in place. So getting the right people in the right roles, but also working hard to develop people within those roles so they're taking on new skills, you know, actually, you know, makes it what we think, and that's what we're aiming for, a nice kind of place to work. You need kind of to have a good reason to want to, yep, to leave, really.
Yeah. And I think that's where kind of your resource planning comes in. Mm. That makes it possible that people can leave at a decent time and don't have kind of ongoing heroism and we need to get this done and next week we need to get this done.
There are always peaks and troughs that come along, and you know, we've been learning as we go as well how to best do resourcing and best do project management. So there are often crunch periods because timelines always move as well. So with the best laid plans, project requirements also change. So we have to work out how we deal with that, and we try and be as open and transparent with the staff as well to say, look, this next period is going to be a busy period, and we're going to need everyone to pull together. There might be some longer hours in that sense.
I think that's a difference. We can see it coming, and we know that it's for a finite period of time. So yeah, I think the last time was Q1 last year, where we had a whole program that was cancelled and the studies needed reporting out quickly. That was one of the triggers. And that meant that we had this bolus of work in Q1 that needed to be delivered. But we were able to communicate that to staff in December and put mechanisms in place to be able to manage it. So, you know, it wasn't enforced. It was, you know, if anyone would voluntarily like to, you know, put in a bit of extra effort, we'll recognise that. And we've managed our way through it.
How did you manage that in the interaction with the client?
It's a good question, actually. I mean, at the time we said, you know, we would do everything that was possible to deliver to the timelines, and that we would, you know, ask our staff and ask our teams whether, you know, they would be willing to, you know, put in the extra effort to help get the job done. But, you know, the kind of the values of the company, we wouldn't enforce that. Mm. We wouldn't be chaining people to their desks and saying you have to work till 9 o'clock at night.
We don't expect people to stay and work evenings, to stay and work all weekend. As we know, many people do for this industry and for other industries. But I think that was one of the driving forces when we started the company, is we didn't want to be running a company where we were expecting that of our staff, because we don't want to be doing that ourselves either. Mm. We choose to because we are running a business, and there are often things that we need to be doing. But we talked about it at the time. That was something that was quite important to us.
Mm. Our clients responded well to it, and actually our team stepped up. And, you know, when it's for a finite period of time, I think it actually in some ways creates a bit of a buzz. You know, it's, you know, come on, let's work together. Let's get through this, which we did. You know, came out the other side to
a
nice kind of balance.
Celebration afterwards?
We did.
Yeah, we did actually.
Yeah, we did. We took everyone out for dinner.
Awesome.
Yeah. That was actually when we went away for the weekend, actually. We took the whole team away for the weekend to a medieval hotel.
Nice.
Friday and Saturday night.
No corporate presentations, just fun. Although it was organised fun. But you know, murder mystery, treasure hunt, shooting, things like that. So
I think that's so important to achieve celebrations. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you never know what's good looks like.
No, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the place itself that, you know, you want to create for people that like to work here. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, that's very much determined by who is working here. So how do you go in terms of your recruitment efforts, especially as you have a really fast growing company?
Well, initially, I suppose when we're smaller and no one had heard about Verimed, there was a lot of contacting people on LinkedIn and contacting people that we'd worked with previously. And then in about 2014, we hired our full-time recruiter, and he had a big difference and on the sort of the amount of people that we could contact. And I suppose at the very beginning, he would send us the CVs to look at, and we were reviewing them with quite a stringent eye, because we have very set criteria as the kind of person we would want to hire, someone that really held the same values as we have, and that really wanted to be passionate about joining a small company. Mm-hmm. And over time, Ken Sen, our recruiter, has adapted and worked with us to actually refine sort of how, so he knows exactly the kind of person that we're looking to hire. And we would always be in any interview, particularly at the very beginning.
You both are still interviewing every person that gets...
Not everybody. No, we were interviewing everybody.
To start with, because one extra person can make a big impact on a small company. So it had to be the right type of person, the right fit to not have the wrong impact. But then when you get to a certain point... and then particularly when I went on maternity leave as well, it's not feasibly possible. And we then had to trust in the more senior team members that we'd hired to hire then the right people as well. So we're still involved in some interviews, particularly of any key staff members of seniority or any sort of new areas within the business that we're hiring in. But otherwise, our recruitment, I suppose, methods and the team of people involved in recruitment, it's evolved. And again, we have a lot of junior people involved in recruiting because it shares the load, because we do.
It also gives people development opportunities as well, involved in things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do.
And to give a voice to them as to, is this a kind of person that you would want to work with? Do you see this person also fitting in with the kind of company that we are at the moment? That's
like
quite
in a tribe,
important.
You want to make sure the tribe all agrees who joins it.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah. So
another thing that we've done over the last few years is a graduate scheme as well. So we're pretty passionate about that. Some companies have started theirs and stopped them, and we've kept ours going, and actually that's been really successful for us.
What does it look like?
So it started probably about 5 or 6 years ago. We hired one or two graduates, and then since that point we started developing a series of introductory training courses that we've written internally, and that became more formalised about 3 or 4 years ago. I went on maternity leave and suddenly we were hiring 6 graduates. And now we have someone in charge of our graduate training program, and it is a 3-month set period where we have defined trainings and projects for them to be working on, to be gaining experience. And it's not just the technical side, it's all the other aspects of working in the industry. So, courses such as presenting skills and
giving and receiving feedback.
And
a lot of the soft stuff.
A lot of the soft skills. So I'm thinking I haven't been in that one for a while.
So Matt, how do you personally give feedback, or how do you want to have feedback being handled at Verimed?
Sure. Okay. Well, the way that we train this, or the way that we are kind of ask our teams to kind of give and receive feedback, is in quite a polite way. So firstly, we ask people to ask for feedback, because I think that's the first important step. You know, ask your peers, ask the people reporting to you, ask your more senior team members for feedback. Because it's a great way to, you know, assimilate information that you might otherwise not be aware of. But also in terms of
you know, when giving feedback. So say I wanted to give someone some feedback, I would actually ask for their permission first. So, it's, you know, is it okay if I give you some feedback about this? Because, you know, we don't want to be in a position where we're just kind of, you know, firing bits of feedback left, right and centre that might not be well received. The other thing that we kind of train as part of our feedback training is around how people receive feedback. And by that, I mean, you know, kind of listening, actively listening, not reacting, you know, making sure people pause and allow the time to kind of absorb that feedback. You know, because feedback is one of those tricky things that some people, you know, might react. And actually, if they react, then you can end up in a situation where people don't want to give feedback anymore, and you end up with this, you know, this kind of breakdown in communication. So, so we kind of train people to do that, and you know, that allows them the time. You know, they don't have to agree with the feedback, and we say that also.
It's a gift that you can accept or not accept.
The way we tend to approach it.
Yeah, I recently saw a video by someone talking about feedback in terms of FBI. It's about the feelings, it's about behavior, and it's about the impact. And I thought that's a really nice acronym to kind of remember. And so yeah, I think that is very important for kind of keeping the culture within the company, and having a good place to work for. Because I think if these kind of communications break down, then you can't have a nice place to work for. So let's talk a little bit more on the personal side. Mm-hmm. So you just mentioned you have now 2 kids, very young one, 3-year-old one. So how do you manage kind of family and work life, especially, you know, that you have been investing a lot of time into your business in the past, and now there's 2 little human beings that are drawing a lot of attention and a lot of probably sleepless nights and things like that.
Yes. So at the moment I'm working part-time, so that I guess is one of the biggest changes from pre-having children, where I was working full-time. I am working 3, sometimes 4 days a week, and it is a juggle. I'm still contactable when I'm out of the office, but I guess for a lot of working parents, there's always a challenge of childcare when your child gets sent home ill, and you've got 10 meetings in your calendar. That you know, that's there's no different for us than other working parents. So,
well, it's your business now.
But there, you know, there is still commitments and meetings and things that have to be done. I think even if you weren't running a business, so we do now. As Matt was saying before, it's easier now in a sense because we are bigger and we have a more established leadership team. So particularly when I was on maternity leave, there was a lot of people stepping in and covering various different aspects of my role. And then the other, I suppose, key thing is we live quite close to where we work. So we have a 10-minute walk as a commute. So from that side of things, that's part of the, it's important, I suppose. We couldn't do it if we had an hour commute, which a lot of people would have. It means that we can come into work, having dropped the kids off at nursery, and still be home every evening, picking them up from nursery and doing bath time and bedtime.
I mean, talking to friends about it, I actually think, you know, in some ways we've kind of got it quite easy in terms of work-life balance. You know, yes, there's often extra stuff to be done in the evenings when the kids are in bed, or occasionally, less so now, stuff to do at the weekends. But actually living so close to work, I'm able to spend an hour with the children in the morning over breakfast before I come into work, and get home every night for bath time, which is, if I was working in the city, it just wouldn't be possible. Mm. You know, I've got friends that work in finance, and, you know, they're kind of Saturday and Sunday dads because, you know, they just don't have that opportunity to be at home before or after work.
Yeah.
Actually, I think I'm quite lucky. But in terms of, you know, what it's like now that the kids have come along, it's almost, in some ways, you know, having three things that you care for and that you're passionate about. Because before the kids, you know, we put our heart and soul into developing and running this business. We're passionate about it. We care a lot about it. It means a lot to us. You know, we're a statistician and a programmer running a statistics and programming business. It's very close to our heart.
I've had to become very good at delegating.
Because
I used to work long, five long days and sometimes weekends. That isn't possible.
Yeah.
So
it forces you to delegate.
It forces me to become very efficient and choosy about where I spend my time or where not to spend my time, and be able to how to effectively or delegate effectively to the people that are supporting me in order to be able to do what I need to do. So that's, I think, the biggest change for me. I can't do everything. I can't do everything to the same level of detail that I once could have. I try, but then you realise you can't do it all. I can't stay late and get something finished off. I have to know I've got a hard stop.
I actually think it's a right, pretty good thing to have these more hard boundaries, because it especially has this effect that you kind of concentrate on what's really important and you say no to, or delegate things that are not that important, or where you have people that actually are better in doing these things.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the hiring comes into place again. So speaking a little bit, you know, at the end about hiring, so you have the offices here in Twickenham, but you also have some other offices, and I think you have also quite a lot of people that work from home, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. So we opened our second office a few years ago up in just outside of Manchester, and then earlier this year we opened an office in Swansea. Yeah.
2019.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Early last year we opened one in Swansea. That shows that I've just been out 6 months. Time is erased. And as you said, we have a number of people that work from home, so I think the challenge for us and for the sort of leadership team is how do we continue that culture, that same Verimed feeling, but in different offices. And that is something that we've been continually looking at and trying to improve upon and work out how we can still have a same culture and be one connected company.
Okay. Interestingly, it's normally financials or something else that appears first in the business plan. In our business plan, the first thing is, you know, maintaining and promoting the Verimed culture.
Okay.
So, you know, we recognise that that's what Verimed is about. So that's the thing we're most keen to kind of protect and develop.
Yeah. So that's a very, very good point. So as we close up, any kind of final thoughts from your end? Because we covered quite a lot. We covered kind of how you started in terms of growing your business, switching over from a freelance or permanent position into growing your own business and putting lots of hours into making sure you hire the right first people, because that has such a big impact on the business, and, you know, having an evolved business model over time where you have, you know, no much more than 100 people in your organization, which is quite a big organization. Still where you want to kind of focus on the culture and on the three big topics that we talked about: a good place to work for, high quality and good service. And so you're continually recruiting now into different offices, now actually around the world, also in the US. And any final thoughts on that?
Well, what I'd say is that if, you know, there's anyone out there who's thinking of starting their own business, that, you know, it's probably not for the faint-hearted. You know, you have to put in a lot of effort to get a business to be successful. But there are rewards, and the rewards are often, you know, more subtle than you might imagine.
It's hugely rewarding, and, you know, now the skill set that I've developed goes so far beyond statistics. I do very little statistics on a day-to-day basis now. And I've realized actually I'm okay with that. I really enjoy all the other aspects of my ever-changing and expanding role. You know, there's still more that we probably haven't done yet that we're still passionate about the company. We're still passionate about seeing it grow and seeing what else we can do with it.
Looking forward to the rest of the journey.
And I think it's really nice that still with your background of a programmer and a statistician, you can always relate to the people that do the actual work and that do the heavy lifting every day.
Mm-hmm. And roll our sleeves up and sometimes, you know, get in and help when needed as well.
Yeah, but I think what's really important is that you always understand when, you know, what does it mean if tables need to be created a week early, or what does it mean when there's issues in the database, or what does it mean if you need to, you know, change something in the business because you have been impacted the same way as your employees are. And I think that's a really big advantage of a leadership team to be able to kind of connect with everybody in the organization in terms of what they're actually doing. So thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Matt and Emma,
for this really, really nice interview. And stay tuned for what's coming next from Veromed.
Thank you, Alexandre.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Check out theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. And join the LinkedIn group and share your experiences and learn from further updates that I give there. Just follow me on LinkedIn and search for The Effective Statistician in the groups. So, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.